Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Reads for the month of November. I'm Emily Bazelon, one of the hosts of Slate's Political GabFest. I am so pleased to be joined today by James Sturm, who is the author of a new adaptation of Watership Down. Hey, James.
Hello, Emily.
And I should say also that this book is adapted and illustrated by you and also Joe Sutphin. Watership Down was originally published in 1972 by Richard Adams. It's an epic fable about rabbits. Hazel and Fiver and their companions are in search of a home. They're looking to establish their own warren, safe from human intrusion on their natural world and also from other rabbits who want to control them. The book is a childhood classic that is not just for children by any means. It was actually banned in China in 1965 because it has a message supposedly about Marxism and government corruption. Though I confess that when I read it as a kid, I didn't think about that at all. James, let's start with just this basic question. What drew you to this book? When was the first time you read it? And do you remember how you responded to it then?
The book has kind of been in my life for as long as I remember, though I didn't read it until I moved to Vermont in 2001. My parents had a copy on their bookcase, and I remember trying to read it and failing. It kind of was very bewildering. The title was bewildering. Like, what's a watership? Why did it go down? There was like this old-fashioned engraving of a rabbit on the cover. The book started with a quote from Agamemnon, and then it launched into like a page-long description of a meadow. And I was like, okay, no thank you. I'm going to go back to my Fantastic Four comics. and I left it there on the shelf. So when I moved to Vermont, the first place we lived was on a dirt road, and we had one car, and I was out in the woods a lot. And my first daughter was just born, Eva, and I was in the Heartland Public Library, and I saw Watership Down out, and I thought, oh, let me check this out. I'll give it another try. And I totally fell in love with it. And as I was like taking walks in the woods, and it just made me so much more alive to the environment, noticing trees and copses and rivers. And his nature writing and descriptions are so vivid. And then what happened, of course, I kept reading and I realized like, wow, this book is a page turner. And it has all the pleasures and joys of the superhero comics that I did love as a kid, you know, good characters and villains. And each character had had a superpower, whether it's like super strong or fast. And then, you know, I read it over and over again over the years.
I feel like this book is, yes, it's a page turner. It has a lot of suspense and drama in it. And I thought your adaptation did a wonderful job of that aspect of the book. I found myself not wanting to put it down at night. So the story is enveloping. I also think the characters are the main thing that at least pulled me in. I remember particularly Hazel and Fiver's relationship from reading it for the first time, I think when I was a kid or a teenager. And, you know, Hazel is the sort of older caretaker of the two of them. Fiver is very vulnerable. He has these visions which freak everybody out, but turn out to be really prescient. Do you see their relationship as kind of fundamental to the book, and what role is it playing?
Yeah, it's certainly central. They're brothers. Hazel has learned to like listen to Fiver. You know, Fiver will have these premonitions that tend to come true and start sticking up for him. Fiver is like a little character that a lot of people dismiss, like, oh, you make up these stories to get attention and this is the way you have powers. Fiver is also kind of a bit of a badass in his own way, too. He really has the courage of his convictions, even when nobody else will believe him. He's willing to walk away from what seems like comfortable situations that nobody else can see are really dangerous. And he's willing to really believe his inner voice. And for that, I really, really love Fiver's character. Yeah, Hazel's just such a wonderful character in the sense that they're kind of like the leader of you know, becomes like the chief rabbit of this warren, and does so not because he's the fastest or the strongest, but really in some ways the most empathetic and the most sensitive, and not willing to leave anybody behind, not allowing anyone to be bullied, willing to like reach out and trust other rabbits who have, you know, forgive rabbits who have wronged him, and even to like forge relationships with other creatures that just seem like just crazy talk to other rabbits.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that he is not the obvious hero character because he's so empathetic and sensitive. I'm sure that's part of why I liked this book as a kid. Which other characters were you especially drawn to? Who do you think stands out?
Kahar, the seagull, is like a great character. It's like this injured seagull that the rabbits kind of nurse back to health and then kind of become friendly with. And it's funny because like this whole idea of like empathy and all these humanistic values, they just don't do that because it's the right thing to do. It's kind of like tactical in a way. When they save this little mouse at one point in the book, like later on, this mouse gives them like really important intel that saves their lives. And Kahar is just like this just very colorful character who's like very worldly, and has seen the world and has been to big water, the ocean. And everybody's kind of like scared and enamored of Kahar. And the other character that I also really love is Captain Holly, who was the head of the kind of the police force of the original Warren, and tries to, threatens and tries to arrest Bigwig and the group that's about to leave. And then later on, like circles back around and joins the Warren. And that rabbit like twice goes through these intense traumas. Like they see their Warren destroyed, almost like in this like, you know, like Auschwitz type scenario,
gassed.
Like where they're gassed and yeah. And then later on, has to go into this like brutal Warren, barely escapes, is also almost mowed down by a train. And somehow like after these two incidents, kind of just like looks trauma in the eye and just like keeps rolling, you know, like just rabbits have this incredible ability of to be resilient. And working on this comic during the pandemic, that was really good to remember and be, you know, and be part of as I was working on this book throughout.
Yeah, I also love Kahar, and there is a not subtle lesson about cross-species cooperation in this book, right? Because the bird, the mouse, later on in the book, there are other animals who come into play and factor into the rabbits' disputes with other rabbits. And it's kind of deus ex machina, but it feels organic to the text because these are all people, or I should say creatures, from the natural world.
Yeah, I also love the names Richard gave to things. Like Kahar sounds like the sound a seagull would make. Kahar, Kahar. And like a hurdy-do, which is like a car or a truck, sounds like what it sounds like when you start an engine. Hurdy-do-do-do-do, hurdy-do-do-do-do. So like when you use that kind of the Lapine language, like it's really fun to like wrap your lips around some of that and read it out loud.
Yeah, and you have a glossary in the back of the book, which I appreciated because you sort of know what they mean throughout, but it's helpful to be able to actually just go look at the definitions.
Yeah, and of course, the glossary was part of the original book, which I just love, too. And I love that they, you know, you can read it and kind of, yeah, get some context, and then you see what it is, and then, you know, hopefully you'll kind of maybe even go back and then read it again.
So what were the challenges of adapting this book to being a graphic novel? I mean, it's very visual. It's famously animated in this cartoon that apparently was so violent that it scared and even tormented a whole generation of British children. I was reading about that this morning.
American children, too. It's the number one comment I think I get from people when they know that I've worked on this book. It's like, I saw that movie and it traumatized me.
So how did you try to depict, let's start with talking about the violence. How did you try to depict the violence in a way that felt true to the text, but wasn't necessarily going to cause people nightmares?
Yeah. I mean, I really just kept going back to the text and trying not to be gratuitous. And, you know, the story is about surviving in the natural world, and it's kind of, it is a bit of a brutal place. But, you know, we tried to do some stuff off camera. We didn't linger on the blood and the gore. Often, you know, you would see perhaps like a fly land on somebody, or we would kind of depict it in a way that was a little more subtle. But there are parts where we don't pull punches, and you know, the rabbits are going after one another, and you know, you do see a little blood here and there.
And what other issues come up? Like, were you reading the book thinking very much about the scenes and how to pace them and how to visually represent the actual movement from one scene or one part up to another?
Yeah. The biggest challenge in some ways was just kind of organizing all the information. When you're doing a graphic novel adaptation, I'm actually thumbnailing the whole book out and I'm blocking it in with pictures visually first, even before I start writing a script, choreographing all the action, and then going to the text and selecting, you know, what text is going to go into the word balloon. When I think about the collaborative process, you know, Richard Adams is the first collaborator, of course, and he supplied this book that is so well written and paced that it really made my job a lot easier. You know, so I basically almost made it like a mathematical formula. I have a friend, Paul Karasik, who, along with Dave Mazzucchelli, did an amazing adaptation of City of Glass, Paul Auster's book. And, you know, he talked to me a little bit about how he, you know, would read the book and he knew how many pages the adaptation was and he knew how much kind of real estate for the adaptation he had for each chapter. So I kind of figured all of that out, knowing that if I saved a little more time here, I'd have a little more space later on in the book where I knew I'd have to open it up and I'd want it to become more cinematographic. So that was part of the process of adaptation. But I felt pretty confident going in because it's so action-packed that it wasn't going to be so hard. I mean, the difficulty is just this many pages over the course of so many years.
I think that the book is entirely or almost entirely told in terms of the words as dialogue, right?
Yes.
Which I thought made it move quickly and gives the characters voices. And was that did you have to work hard to make that happen? Or is there so much good dialogue from Adams that you could use that?
Yeah. So my collaborator Joe Sutphin is really an amazing artist and illustrator. We went to England to do visual research, and we actually got a tour of the rabbit's journey going to Watership Down, to Ephrafra. And I was blown away that these things were actually real places. I know there's a map in the book as well, but when I read it, this American boy didn't know that it was an actual real map, you know. We both took a lot of photos and videos. And when it was time to draw, so much of the visual descriptions could be drawn. You know, that old chestnut, a picture says 1,000 words, was very apt in this case. I did want to keep people really in the present, like rabbits are, and really alive to the environment, and not kind of distance the reader with an overlay of narration and caption boxes. And I felt like that just moved the action along a little bit. And then, of course, there were exceptions, like when rabbits were recounting stories or telling stories to one another, or folktales to one another.
Yeah, I'm looking at this one scene that stood out to me a lot. There's a moment in the book where a couple of rabbits have to interact with humans, and you use the headlight from the car in this really effective way that gives you the sense of like the rabbits caught in the glare and their eyes, you know, are turning red in that way that happens when you see someone's eyes. And then there's like this hand that scoops down and there's no dialogue there. And then the rabbits start talking again.
Yeah, that's the rabbits call that going tharn, T-H-A-R-N, like when you freeze in front of a bright light, and that happens to animals, and they're really afraid that happens. It's funny, as I've been doing kind of media and interviews on Watership Down, I always think to myself, don't go tharn, James. Don't go tharn once the cameras start rolling or you're being recorded.
If you do that now, we'll just cut it.
Fair enough. I love, I've drawn a lot of panels of comics in my career. So some are a little more interior and some are a little more action-packed. I've done several comics about baseball. So kind of choreographing action is really fun to do. Working out all those thumbnails was a really fun challenge to take on. And one of the reasons I wanted to work on this book, and this, I'm sure this has happened to you too, where you get maybe invited to write a quote or an introduction to a book and you're busy, but you say to yourself like, oh, I really want to spend some time with this writer. Like, I really want to reflect on it. And unless I like do this professionally, I might not pick up this book and spend time doing it. And when I had the opportunity to do this, I that was part of my thinking. It's like, this is a book I want to spend time with. This is a book I've read many, many times. Every time I read it, like, I feel like I see something I didn't see before. Let's do it.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
So you are a hugely voracious reader, I know, from being friends with you for a long time. What kind of literary tradition do you see Watership Down as fitting into? Is it like a YA classic? Do we think of it in that sort of, you know, epic journey, Bildungsroman of a young rabbit? Or are you, I was also thinking a little bit about George Orwell, though I couldn't decide if that was a stretch. Anyway, just wonder what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Richard Adams might say that's a stretch because he said repeatedly, this is just a story about rabbits. And I don't know if I believe him because, you know, somebody he was very well read and read the classics and studied literature. So he must have had some sense that what he was doing there. That's a great question. And you know, I think the thing with Watership Down, it is like a really weird book and it doesn't fit into like a category. And from what I understand, like, you know, every publisher in England rejected him several times before it found publication and they just didn't know what to do with it. It's like, it's not, you know, is it for kids? Is it for adults? Nobody quite knew. And I actually assigned the book to students of mine at the Center for Cartoon Studies because I thought, well, there'll be something for everybody in this book, whether you like nature writing, whether you like You know, the political parables, whether you're a superhero fan. So it crosses a lot of different lines, and I think that's part of its enduring appeal. And you know, now with publishing, everything has certain categories. Like if Catcher in the Rye came out today, like would it be a YA novel? Like maybe, right? Like it definitely is. You know, it's an environmental story. It's an adventure story. There's also this kind of like Band of Brothers war story to it, because I think some of it reflects Richard Adams's he was a World War II veteran and fought in the war. So I think a lot of the characters are based on people that he fought alongside.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I can't help but think of Animal Farm, right? Because it's like a bunch of animals and they're so... But I also felt like that was sort of wrong, that the allegory of Animal Farm is so obvious. Like it's supposed to be the whole point. Whereas I actually had never really thought about the kind of underlying politics of this book until I started reading for this interview, at which point I... you know, discovered that China had banned it, as I said earlier, in 1965, which I thought was kind of wild, because I don't feel like whatever anti-Marxist message is here, that it's so apparent. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, when I think about, I mean, I read Animal Farm years and years ago, and I really don't remember the characters, but I remember that it was a political message, and I remember the basics of what it's about. But I think when you read Watership Down, because you remember the characters, and though they are so moving, and I still cry when I get to the end of the book. Like I am so moved by the end of it, and I love the characters so much that the political messages aren't kind of on the forefront. And I think also like the other kind of political allegory, if you will, in the book is that whole Warren of Snares, where they go to a warren and there's just these very fat, comfortable rabbits with plenty to eat. And there's a farmer that gives them food. But you can enjoy all this, but you just can't ask any questions. You can't look too deeply about anything because, you know, it might reveal like this pact that you've made to keep that lifestyle. That's almost as I don't know. I found that also as a political allegory very, very relevant to today as well in our society.
Yeah, and that reminds me of the fable by Ursula Le Guin, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, which is a really chilling tale about exactly that kind of sacrifice. And I see it's from the same era because it was written in 1974. I had another, I guess, semi-political question about this book, which I think one of the challenges for a reader in 2023 is that it is very much a book driven by the male perspective. The does, the female rabbits, really only show up so that they can be captured and thus provide litters for the warren. And they're just like not very memorable characters. Like their job is to kind of be rescued, like the classic damsels in distress. And I know you thought about this, and I'm just curious how you grappled with that problem in the novel.
It's very true. And they do not play a prominent role. I was listening to a podcast where Richard's daughters were actually talking about this. And by the time, this book started as a story that Richard Adams would tell his daughters when they were young on car rides to help the time go along. And by the time he actually wrote the book and it was coming out, I think they were like college age or around there. And they kind of challenged him on that as well. I think the story is very much like this kind of Band of Brothers that is reflecting his kind of wartime experience to a certain extent. And also he was a man of his times. From what I understand, the female character with the most agency is this rabbit called Heisenthley, who is like a really actually kind of cool character. She kind of has Fiverr's psychic abilities, but she also... she's also ready. She's really super brave and ready to, try to fight and defend herself and kick some ass like her male counterparts. And from what I understand in Richard wrote Tales of Watership Down, like he kind of returned to this world. And later down the line, Heisenthley became the chief rabbit of the Warren. So I think Richard himself like tried to make a corrective, and I don't know if that just, you know, came from the urgings of his daughters, or you know, he came to that himself, and maybe hearing similar criticism of the book.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I did try to think about it. Certainly, like I was going, the plan was to remain faithful to the book. I think I've seen other adaptations where they introduce women characters and then they make it worse. You know, like. They become the characters that the men just fight over, and they're batting their eyelashes, and it's just really cringy. So I feel like there's an omission here in a way, but I feel like there isn't an insult to that injury.
I think you're right. I mean, it feels like it would be cheating to try to rewrite that aspect of the text for our modern feminist sensibilities, right? Like, the book has its limitations. It was written in 1972. He probably just wasn't thinking about it very much, even though he had daughters.
Yeah. And you know, does every story have to have every type of character in it, right? Like, this is a story that just that doesn't. And I don't know, you can play ifs and buts with this, but it is what it is, you know, and, you know, hopefully that omission doesn't take away from all the wonderful things that it does offer.
Yes. Last question. So what is Watership Down? It's the name of a place in Britain. And which part of the English countryside are we talking about?
Right. So it is southwest of London by about an hour or so. And it's just gorgeous English countryside. And Watership, the Downs, you know, like Watership Down is an actual like hill. I mean, it's just as it's depicted in the book. It's you get to the top of this hill, and it's breathtaking. It really is. And you know, the Warren, the honeycomb Warren where they all lived, like that tree is gone, but you can still kind of see where it was. And you know, you'll see some like wood railings, and people will scratch. People have visited it. It's almost like people go on pilgrimages there. They'll scratch like, you know, Fiverr was here, Hazelrath forever. And it's very moving. Like it really felt like we were on like hallowed ground when Joe and I, and we were with Richard's daughters, Roz and Juliet. It was very moving to kind of be up there and be entrusted to kind of make this adaptation.
Yeah, it really is a kind of gift of trust to give over a work like this. And I hope that this adaptation helps it find a whole new audience, both generationally and internationally. Thanks so much for joining me.
It was my pleasure, Emily. Thanks for having me.
That is it for this month's edition of Gabfest Reads. Our producer is Shayna Roth. Ben Richmond is Senior Director of Operations of Podcasts at Slate. And Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. We'll be back next month with another conversation about another book. Until then, all three of us, David, John, and I, will be back in your feed on Thursday with a new episode of the Slate Political Gabfest. Thanks so much for listening.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.